Okay, we're going to get going. Jennifer is I guess, in hiding or something. Sorry for the wait. We called Jennifer's secret cell phone, and she's not answering. So maybe, I don't know, whoever got a drunk last night, it's your fault. So we're going to continue with the law panel. I'll let them do their own introductions. Effectively, this is what to expect. It's going to be an open forum. We have a good friend of mine, a civil attorney. And we have a guy who's a prosecutor, and we tried to have a criminal defense attorney up here, Jennifer, but she kind of disappeared.
Scared her off.
She was afraid of you guys. So if you two would like to make a statement or
statement. Sure. Hello.
Not bad.
My name. That was good, huh? All right.
Yes, I've complained about the air conditioning again.
I'm happy to see so many of the people that I work with here in the audience. I could have a 100% success rate in spotting the Fed. So anybody who wants to talk with me after, if you need a T-shirt, let me know, and maybe we can work something out, because you can run, but you cannot hide.
Bring it down.
Nice to see you again.
I'm going to go hunt for Jennifer.
I'm a federal prosecutor from San Diego, California. My name is Mitch Denben. And Peter asked me to do this, and I agreed, because I thought it made sense to do a little bit of reality checking. Talk about what we really prosecute versus what people think we prosecute, and kind of give some people a comfort level. And the reason I'm willing to do that is, you know, we talk a lot about what's legal and what's illegal. And a lot of the things that people do are, if you look at the books, are illegal, but they don't get prosecuted for it. And what that does is kind of embolden people to do things beyond the norms and say, hey, they didn't get hit for something that is illegal, like, you know, just jumping into a system and jumping out without access. Wow, that means that, you know, I did something illegal and I got away with it, I could do more. Because that's not the kind of stuff we're looking at. So what I want to talk to you about is what we really prosecute versus what we really don't, and maybe that way clear up some of the myths and some of the legends and go from there. That's what I'll talk about. Brian?
First of all, I'm not a Fed. I've been just harassed by, I don't know, it's like, do people really think their feds are going to send some fat, bald guy out here to...
Does he look like a Fed?
Yeah, I must. I don't know. I tend to give the feds a little more credit. Maybe next year they'll pull a double switch and have flood the place with fat, bald guys. Yeah. You know, it wouldn't cost much. Basically, I'm a civil practitioner. I am not interested in throwing anyone in jail. I just want your money. I'm here to... I'm just here to scare the bejesus out of everyone and talk about the civil ramifications of unauthorized computer access and just where I see civil litigation coming from in the next few years and how it will affect newbie hackers, Uber hackers, or anyone else. I see considerable liability coming for insurance companies and for insurance companies representing all the new startup internet security consultants and firewall experts. And that's what I'm going to go into after the discussion of the criminal matters. Okay, sorry. So basically, I'm going to after we touch on the criminal aspects, I'm going to hit you where your pocketbook is. I'm going to talk about where you may be civilly liable, whether you're a hacker or in the internet security community.
All right, let's talk about criminal stuff first. Here's the kind of stuff we do. Stealing is wrong. Remember, thou shalt not steal? Remember that one? One of those commandment things? It's been wrong since we've had civilization. It's been wrong. It always will be wrong. It's wrong today. It'll be wrong tomorrow. Stealing is wrong. We should have been taught that as children. Stealing, taking something that doesn't belong to you, is wrong. And while it could be a lot of fun, I mean, who didn't shoplift when they were a kid? I mean, while it could be a lot of fun and exciting and challenging to take something that doesn't belong to you, it really sucks if you're on the other end of it, particularly if it's something personal to you. So stealing, if you're out there stealing stuff, then you got a problem with us. I don't care about people rooting around systems for the most part. But when you take something that doesn't belong to you, that's the kind of stuff that pisses people off and what gets us going and gets us. We have a very slow, cumbersome process in order to go after people. But when one steals, then we actually crank it up. You heard the other day talk about a $5,000 limit. Well, that's not true. I don't want to want you to think that you're safe if you steal less than $5,000. It's actually not true. In the part of the computer crime statute, it's 18 U.S.C. 1030A4, if you happen to care to look. If you break into a computer with intent to defraud, then there is no $5,000 limit. It's a felony right out the bat. It doesn't matter. So stealing credit cards and using them, doing anything where you intend to get money from somebody by misrepresenting or by just by sleight of hand, is the kind of stuff that gets us annoyed and gets the victim annoyed, more appropriately, and we go ahead and look at people who steal. What else do we take seriously? We take malicious behavior seriously. It is wrong. It has always been wrong. It probably will always be wrong to destroy or damage property that doesn't belong to you. It's just not cool if you're thinking about walking down a street and throwing a rock through somebody's window. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that, gee, that was wrong. And yeah, it's wrong in this in the physical world, and it's also wrong in the cyber world. What we tend to look at, because we're not terribly smart, is that we look for a physical world counterpart to the kind of behavior that we see in cyber. So that if something is wrong and you know it to be wrong in the physical world, it's probably going to be wrong in the cyber world, and it's the kind of stuff that you look at. So destroying property is just not a good thing to do. It's just not cool. So as a consequence, when we see that kind of behavior, malicious behavior, that is the kind of thing that once again gets us interested. Now that does have the $5,000 threshold. Just to make things perfectly clear, if you do damage, delete, destroy information, and it costs the victim more than $5,000 to repair the damage, then it meets the federal jurisdictional threshold. I mean, it's kind of silly when you think about it, actually. What we're doing is encouraging bad net citizenship. So if you have like a real good, if you're a solid ISP and you get hacked into and a guy takes down a bunch of files and, you know, roots around and does a lot of damage, and you have to hire a consultant, for example, to come in and figure out where the damage was done, to patch the holes and work up things, you're more than $5,000 right off the bat. And that particular person, you know, can be looking at federal prosecution. If, on the other hand, you're a good ISP, a good net citizen, and you have pretty serious security, and you have sysmanagers who understand security, who catch the break-in fairly early, and it's somebody, you know, actually consider that the two crackers have the same absolute intent. They just want to do damage. And let's say, for example, they do the absolute same damage. They go in, they get some access, they destroy personal web pages, they steal personal information, they just cause a ruckus. But this particular second ISP is serious about security, catch the break-in fairly early, have good backups, are able to restore the deleted files quickly, they patch up right away, because usually patch up right away. And as a consequence, it's taken maybe a couple of sysadmins half a day to put back together. What's that cost the company? $1,500 in time? No federal jurisdiction. Zero. So the good net citizen gets no action from us, and the bad net citizen, somebody who doesn't give a whit about security, their case gets looked at by us, which is kind of weird and kind of disturbs any right-thinking person, I think. Maybe not. Oh, we have a question from the audience. As a practical matter, the prosecution is done where it's easier to prosecute. So in a case where, let's just say someone from New York hacks into a company or hacks into a naval facility in San Diego, not that that's ever happened, the most likely site of prosecution would be the place of the victim computer system, because it's easier on the victim for the prosecution to occur there. The only time that doesn't really work is with juveniles. The juvenile system doesn't work that well on the federal side. Part of the reason for that is that the computer crimes are not listed as delineated juvenile delinquency offenses So as a consequence, you have to get permission from the local DA to prosecute it federally. Oftentimes that's forthcoming, sometimes not. The problem, the federal system doesn't have any juvenile detention facilities. We're lucky in California, that because we have a very powerful juvenile justice system, that a federal case, a federal juvenile case in California, the federal judges have access to the California Youth Authority sentence so that if appropriate, someone can be sent to prison. Also, we have a pretty good working relationships with our DAs around the state, so we get the juveniles taken care of that way. You a lawyer by some chance? Oh, okay. Yeah, whatever you said. Sir.
My question is about the legality of reverse engineering. A lot of people say on the internet or when you read through different materials that as long as it's for demonstration purposes or that you have this 24-hour window, these potential warnings that go out there, that it's legal to present this information for informational purposes. But the use of it or the intended result is often considered illegal. Is this a real distinction or is this...
Did anybody hear that question? We talk about reverse engineering and the legality of posting. A lot of that will run into the civil arena. As a practical matter, I'll just answer this very quickly. On the criminal side, if we get into a situation where we have a battle of the experts, where the prosecution has to call somebody to say, this is something that was created by reverse engineering, and the defense expert can say, well, it was readily apparent, it really didn't have to be reverse engineered. We don't do those cases criminally. You're not really looking at a criminal case, for the most part, in a reverse-engineered product. But it does have, on the civil arena, it's a lot easier to do. So I'll shift to Brian on that.
Well, the intellectual property aspects of it, I'm not an intellectual property attorney. I know that the guys who do that work make far more money than I do. But essentially, there's a question of intent. What was your intent in posting it? Right. And... you know, once again, you can come out and say, well, my intent was educational purposes, but if you have a history, if there's evidence of intent otherwise, basically in the civil arena, you go before a jury and your burden of persuasion is preponderance of the evidence. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. Preponderance of the evidence is more likely than not. 51% to 49%, and you know those are the questions that when you consider your jury pool and your burden of persuasion, you know, do you want to really put that question before 12 people who really weren't even smart enough to get out of jury duty? And you know, those are intellectual property questions. I'm frankly not prepared to discuss. I don't know. You know.
Sir. I can't hear you. For federal jurisdiction, for the most part, you have to have attacked a protected computer. A protected computer is one that's used in interstate commerce or interstate communications. So what we look to see in a given case, let's just say you send a threat over the internet, over an email threat to your next-door neighbor. If it happens to pass through, let's just say, AOL in Virginia, then there's going to be federal jurisdiction for it. If it never leaves the state of California, or the state of Nevada, if that's where you are, then there could not be federal jurisdiction for that particular offense. If you put a modem pool within a given state, it would make it more difficult for us to establish federal jurisdiction. We'd have to prove that the communications involved actually went outside state lines. If we have a difficult time proving that, we would defer to the locals. So it would likely result in more local prosecution versus federal.
So if a local connection to a local ISP within the state was rated by the Public Utilities Commission as being an out-of-state call. That still does not call the FBI or anybody else that deals with federal issues into prosecuting that case?
It doesn't matter what they call it. What we're concerned with is the reality.
Okay. Thanks.
Wait for the mic. That way we can, because I'm not repeating questions very well.
Who determines the damages for the $5,000 limit? Because like the New York Times quoted some ridiculous number for being defaced. Can you just make up this number?
No, actually, the law requires that whatever losses that someone incurs as a result of a malicious act have to be reasonable. So it's not even what they actually incur. If you make the mistake of paying $50,000 for somebody that reasonably would charge $10,000, then odds, if there's an argument about that, the argument is resolved in favor of what is reasonable. And we actually have to prove up the losses. And so the answer is no, it's not just whatever somebody says it is. We actually have to document it, and we can only use it to the extent that it's reasonable. Which is why there's not a lot of cases there are some cases on website defacement. I mean, most people just look at that as graffiti, but it's entertaining without really bother with it. But if you take the site down and make the information inaccessible for an extended period of time, then it becomes malicious. I mean, the line between something that's entertaining and kind of a fun sort of prank to something that's malicious is a continuum. It's one of those things that you know it when you see it, and you all know it when you do it. But to answer your question directly, is the losses have to be documented and they have to be reasonable.
And on the civil side, we run into very difficult problems in proving damages in these kind of cases as well. What it comes down to, well, was there trade secrets stolen? What's the value of those trade secrets? We copied someone's customer list. We didn't deprive them of it. But if someone takes your customer list and solicits all your customers and your sales go down noticeably, you've been damaged. There's tremendous problems in proving up damages in these kind of cases, often requiring expert testimony from economists and you name it, internet security specialists. It's a difficult area.
Trade secret theft is really difficult, primarily if something is taken while in development. The issue is, what's the loss? Is it the cost of development? The product may never reach the market, so that there really isn't an actual loss. It becomes very difficult for us to figure those cases, and there's not a lot of federal cases on it. Sir?
Yes, sir. If you guys were IT managers, what steps would you take to educate your corporate attorneys on people you catch hacking internally, you know, like prosecution?
You know, that actually enters both of our areas. From my perspective, that there is an interest in corporations understanding what criminals are doing within their system, if in fact there are criminals within their system. I think it's important for them to know that, and there's an interest, general societal interest, in rooting out evil, if in fact evil is what is occurring. But there's a far greater interest for corporations to take a serious look at their security, and it's called money. And Brian
exactly.
will talk about that.
I'm my job, if I'm defending a corporate entity which may be used as a springboard for an attack, or a security consultant or security company who is charged and has taken on the job of preventing such attacks, is not rooting out evil. It is protecting my client from liability. And, you know, the question you asked is nebulous and really huge. I mean, if you find your employees actually participating in cracking activities, you have to take a serious look at it. You have to talk about bringing in the authorities. You have to contact your insurer.
Let me refine that again. Let's say you catch somebody doing something pretty malicious internally, maybe to yourself or someone outside. How do you guys, if you're an IT manager, how would you educate? Because normally your attorneys aren't very smart on anything, really, except for like prosecuting DUI people or whatever. But how do you educate them? What steps would you guys take to educate them on perhaps something, you know, maybe hire a consultant? Were those some of the options that you guys would suggest?
Well,
is it just a crazy question? Or?
Well, no. I mean, it's a very real world question, and it depends on a number of factors. If I'm if I'm an in-house counsel representing a corporation and I become aware that my company's computers are being used for attacks, or you know, actually employees are being attacked from within, we bring the authorities in right away. We bring the authorities in, and then we do some severe risk analysis and find out, to the best of our ability, internal investigation on what's happened, what's the, you know, if it's a one-time thing, if it's been going on for months, do some quick damage assessment, contact our insurers, you know, get the ball rolling to protect the company's assets, whether it be, you know, springboard liability and whatnot. But definitely, I think you have to bring in the authorities the minute you're aware of such an attack.
One of the more interesting parts of that, to the extent a company has its assets kept in digital format, I mean, they want to be able to protect them. And if somebody steals their trade secret, they want to be able to sue civilly or get the federal authorities interested in prosecuting. Unfortunately, the law defines a trade secret as something that not only is secret, but that the company has taken reasonable measures to protect. If the company does not engage in any security practice, how has it taken reasonable measures to protect its secret? So that's one of the easy doors through which corporate managers can start understanding that there's a price to be paid for only being worried if the printer is working.
Right, and that's where I see in the next 5 years as an exploding area of litigation. The reasonableness of the steps taken by the companies to protect the data of computer network people to secure their systems, to prevent them from being used as a springboard, that sort of thing. Because one of the areas I was charged with here was to, you know, basically scare the hell out of the young hackers. And the bottom line is that let's assume that there's been an attack, and let's assume we've been able to prove damages. Let's say we have $5 million of actual damages that we can prove in court. I'm not going to get that from some 20-year-old college kid, you know, unless he hits the lottery or comes up with a great patent next year. But what I can do is I can go after the companies that he jumped through. I can go after their security consultants who, you know, I will sue the kid. And you know why I will sue him is I will sue him basically to use him as a tool to get to the people who have the deep pockets. I will sit him down in deposition, and I will ask him every technique that he used to pull this off. And if I can somehow establish that he used an exploit that was known, that they've been talking about here at DEF CON for the last 5 years, that any reasonable security expert should have known about and should have taken steps to prevent, I will be attempting to dip into their pockets to make my client whole. And I see that. There's not a lot of cases now. You hear the scuttlebutt, and there's law review articles coming out projecting this as the burgeoning area of civil litigation in the next few years. And I think that's where it's going to go, and I think people, in-house attorneys at the various, you know, security consultants or springboards should be aware of that now.
Do you want to say hello, Jennifer?
Hi. I'm Jennifer Granick. I'm a criminal defense attorney. Sorry I'm late. I was in the bar, and I thought this was going to be in the room that the CDC thing was on, and so since it was on the TV in there, I thought, oh, I don't have to worry until they're done with all of that. So I apologize for being so late. But if you guys have any criminal questions you want the defense perspective on, you can direct those towards me.
I've already turned them to the good side of the force. It is your destiny.
I have a question about as far as intent goes and things like gray hat hacking and things where, you know, maliciousness is not always as apparent. Take, for example, someone who's showing a company, oh, you know, I broke into your system. This is your security holes. This is what I got. This is how you fix it. But they weren't hired by the company, and it wasn't so, you know, cut and dry. How do you deal with the not so obvious?
The question of intent in a criminal case is always the most difficult. And you can the only way, and the jury is instructed, that the only way that you can make a decision about intent is by looking at the person's actions, what they said, what they did, both before and after the action that we're looking at. And we have to prove criminal intent. It's important. The situation that you posit is one that there are gray hat hackers who go ahead and scan a system, find a vulnerability. The question comes up once they go ahead and exploit the vulnerability. Have they done so with pure motive, or is their motive less than pure? If the message they send to the company is, I found a vulnerability in your system and I exploited it, and if you pay me $15,000, I'll repair it for you. Otherwise, I'm going to post it. Then we have a situation of what we call extortion, taking something that doesn't belong to you.
Well,
and it would be extortion. That's right.
I want to respond to that because I don't think that's an accurate reflection of what the law is. 1030 does not, the prosecutor's going to give you the gloss on it, but the truth is that 1030 doesn't require maliciousness. 1030 requires knowledge. So regardless of the purity of your motives, if you have knowledge that you're gaining unauthorized access, you can violate the unauthorized access statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 1030. And I have had cases where a security company offered to provide services to an internet business, and the system operator of the internet business said, well, they don't know anything. Their own security is not good. And the security company said, yes, it is. And the system operator broke into their system and stole one of the internet company's own proprietary documents that was stored on the security company's server, showed it to his manager and said, look, they're not secure. I stole our own proprietary information off their server like that. And then the manager brought it to the security company, and then the security company brought it to the FBI. And that's a violation of 1030 because he gained unauthorized access. His motives were pure to protect his company from the mistake of hiring a security company that was full of shit. But nonetheless, he still had to meet me. So maliciousness is not always an element of the statute. Your motives can be pure and you can still get...
If Jennifer hadn't been in the bar and was here when we were talking about this earlier, she would have heard what I talked about at the beginning about there are things that may be technically illegal, and we can debate forever the areas of technical illegality versus real illegality, but the good prosecutors only do the cases where maliciousness is clear, at least to us.
And with
That's true. That's absolutely true. There are bad prosecutors as there are bad computer system managers.
I'm really quickly to that. The law should not criminalize things that are not prosecutable. The law should clearly say what's going to be illegal and not illegal, and we shouldn't depend upon the good graces and discretion of some prosecutor to protect our rights.
Your argument's not with me. Your argument is with the Congress of the United States, the representatives of the people here today. If you want to change the law, be my guest. What we only try and do is take the worst of the worst off the street. If I prosecuted every single act that's been made illegal by the Congress, I wouldn't be here enjoying your company today. I'd be too busy. So we're forced, as a result of resource allocation, to only skim the cream. And those of us who do our job responsibly do that. There are others, and we both know them. But the reality is, if you're looking at what you can do and what you can't do, if that's what we're here to talk about, if you're knowingly engaging in malicious activity and you're doing damage or you're stealing something, you're going to be talking to us.
And one aspect that becomes involved with trade secrets, especially in large corporations, is it actually secret or has it been made available to the public? I've had a case in the civil arena suing an oil company who will remain nameless, where I was in court jumping up and down trying to get access to some documents, and we had an army of lawyers on the other side basically saying that it would be the end of the world as we know it if I was able to get these documents. And essentially, I had the documents in my hand, and I got the documents from the oil company's website the night before. So I was able to tell the judge, the end of the world is here, Your Honor, but I still need copies of these documents given to me under oath. And the upshot was it resulted in a $10,000 discovery sanction for the oil company. But what happens a lot of times is these companies, the larger the company, the left hand may not know what the right hand is doing. they can be jumping up and down screaming trade secret, yet their public relations department has posted the information in a press release 6 months ago. So, you know, that's an issue that comes up from time to time.
To the civil litigator, as a someone that's working independently doing security auditing for someone, what steps would you recommend that person take to protect themselves in the event that the company gets broken into afterwards? Insurance. Whether
as far as to protect your assets?
Yeah, you can knock off the ETS too.
Right. Yeah. I think what you need to do, one, is look at your form of business. You may want to go into an LLC, a corporation. You want to get insurance. You want to get E&O coverage. And the amount of coverage you need, I think you need to look at, do a good analysis of your exposure. What is the likely exposure, or what is the possible exposure that, you know, is gonna fall your way? And go out and spend some money and get insurance and talk to an attorney. Talk to an attorney. Look at your documents. Some of these things you can contract away with your clients. Because you're in a risky business. You may be doing everything right, and still there may be some evil genius in the back of the room who may crack your firewall even though you did nothing wrong. He just may have tripped on. You might not have been negligent, but if there is damage, they're going to look to you. So protect yourself by maybe changing your form of business, look into E&O coverage, and discuss with your clients a way to contract out and get an indemnification clause from them. You may not get it. I wouldn't give it to you, but they might, depending on if your talents are so critical to their success and they want you, they may be willing to negotiate with you and hold you harmless from any events. Don't count on it, but it's worth a shot.
We got to pass the mic around so people can hear what's going on. I know you want to keep it, rock out. But.
Hey, you had mentioned code section, what I believe 1300 or 1301, about criminalizing unauthorized access.
1030.
Thank you. What does this do in a situation where you've got a company like Yahoo that's checking into deep links at various other websites when those websites specifically don't want that deep linking done? Does that criminalize that behavior also?
Generally, I'll just make it clear. Generally, business-to-business behavior, unless somebody's stealing someone else's property, is not something that we look at. A deep linking, I guess you're talking at a basic or exceeding unauthorized access, if it's even that. I mean, recognize one of the things that's a reality, even though Jennifer doesn't think it's a good thing. If you simply exceed authorized access or access without authority, a protected computer, and obtain information, and do nothing more than that, that's a misdemeanor. There is almost no federal prosecutor in the country that will willingly accept a misdemeanor case. We just don't do them because we're too damn busy doing other stuff. So if it gives you a comfort level to know that you can access a protected computer and obtain information and you probably won't get prosecuted, fine. You know, go home with that knowledge and sleep secure. But on the other hand, don't let that embolden you, is my message, to go beyond and enter the felony zone, which is steal stuff or damage stuff, because then we'll be talking to you.
I just want to add that there is a case that sort of touches on what I think you're talking about, which is the Bidder's Edge case, in which a company called Bidder's Edge, like a bidder in an auction, was doing mining of other auction sites and compiling them all so people could see what the best price was on an auction. And eBay then went back and sued them, saying that they had gained unauthorized access to eBay's system by collecting this information and using it in their own business. So this is something that we're seeing worked out, not so much in the criminal context for the reasons that my colleague has so excellently stated, but in the civil context.
Don't try and make up now.
So in that case, there could be civil damages as opposed to criminal prosecution.
Right, okay. Exactly.
I pass the mic back to.
Yeah, I just have a question of where on the prosecutorial and defense side is counter-strike hacking, or hacking back, as we saw recently with the World Trade Organization denial-of-service attacks, which were reversed and sent right back to the group of hackers, which was malicious, caused damage, but at the same time was simply just a deflection of what they were doing.
The problem with counterattack is that to the extent that you are sniffing a system that doesn't belong to you in order to keep going up the chain, then you're probably violating the federal wiretap statutes. There are no protections, or there's no exception under the federal wiretap statutes for trespassers. And the federal wiretap statute doesn't only apply to government activity, but it also applies to private activity. So if you can hack back to somebody without sniffing a system that you don't have rights to, then you're probably in violation of federal law. Would you be prosecuted? The odds are, I would say no, because we wouldn't want to be in a position of trying to explain to a jury why you're a bad person for going back after somebody who did some damage to you. It's the kind of thing we would hope can be worked out in the civil arena, particularly if you violated some federal statutes on the way. So hacking back is not a good idea if you're going to be looking to the government to protect you down the road, and maybe a bad idea if you're otherwise in hot water with the government because of the wiretap laws. It's our favorite statute. It's a lot easier to prove a federal wiretap violation than almost anything else that a cracker can do. Most crackers, one of the first things they do is put the sniffer in order to get other passwords and logins. And that's the kind of thing we don't have to prove much, only that it was an interception that occurred. So that's, if there's any other advice I can have you take away from this, is don't do that. Here comes the mic. Okay. Unless you want to talk real, stand up and talk real loud. Practice your public speaking.
Yes. Get out there with the people. I
sort of have a question on the extent of liability and insurance, and I'm going to use an analogy here. If I leave my car in the red light district with the keys in it running, the door's unlocked, law's not going to do a whole lot to protect me if I put a sign on it that says, steal this car. How far is the law going to go to protect systems that are basically set up wide open, big welcome mat on it saying, come on in?
You just couldn't help yourself? Are you going to be able to sell that to the blue-haired old women and retirees that are sitting on that jury?
I'm not a lawyer, so I wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah, no, I think I'd have a better chance of selling them that I'm a male model than than that story. Well, so, you know, think about it. I mean, you don't have to persuade me because you're paying me. I'll believe you. but you're gonna have to persuade the people who are sitting on that jury that, geez, I just couldn't help myself. It was, you know, and it's not going to fly.
That argument actually comes up in some of the criminal cases, too, the argument that you didn't exceed authorized access if the system was so poorly configured that, you know, pretty much anybody with some basic skill can walk in. And that gets back to the old concepts of right and wrong. If you know that you're doing wrong, then you probably are. And we can argue all day about whether people deserve what happens to them. I mean, just because I forget to lock my apartment one day, does that give a neighbor the right to open the door and take my stereo? I don't think so. I mean, who would say that that's okay? I mean, if I happen to leave my shades open at night and somebody, you know, creeps through the bushes, climbs a tree to take a peek at me in the nude, I mean, you know, the peeping Tom thing, who thinks that's good? I mean, that kind of obtaining information, you know that it's wrong.
Yeah,
I mean, exactly, nobody. But you don't know what you're getting until you peek in the window. You see me, you go, shit, I climbed the tree for nothing. Jennifer had the tree cut down outside her house.
There's no trees outside my house.
That's where we have a cross complaint because both sides are damaged.
Yeah. Send the mic back to the man with the hat.
Let's get the mic.
Somebody stole our mic.
Oh, sorry. The other guy was there.
Somebody should play Jerry Springer and kind of roll around.
Should I do it?
As an extension to the previous question there, how does implied access, I mean, if you go to a government website, you know, it's public, there's no passwords, you generally assume you're allowed to go in, look around to anything that's linked there. So they're giving you access to certain files within a certain directory structure in the system. Now, if on that same box I had an open net BIOS share with no password, there's nothing at the front gate telling you don't enter, but because there's nothing, it's just like your website, you're giving them access. But in this case, it happens to be the entire drive. How does that really differ from a legal standpoint?
On the civil side, we're basically looking at a trespass analysis here. If I invite you in, if I'm a bar owner and I invite you in to come in and have a good time, that's fine.
And Jennifer will be there.
Jennifer will be there longer than she should. But if you then sit at my bar and reach across the bar and grab my margarita bowl and throw up into it or something, you have exceeded your access and your authorization, and you have caused me damage.
That did not happen.
I'll ask my question later.
And you know, when you're talking about government websites, I do a lot of legal research on government websites because they're excellent. But, you know, usually, once again, in the civil arena, you're talking about reasonableness. And when you're talking about reasonableness, you're talking about what can I persuade a jury with that preponderance of the evidence standard. And it's not that hard. If there are hard cases, those are the ones that get litigated and make law. But we don't have that law right now, but you know.
I actually look at what the end result is. If you get access because the system has been so poorly configured, the website is so bad that you get into it, that you get into places you shouldn't, and then you just start deleting files, at that point, you know, there's no question that you know what you're doing is wrong, and I'm with you. You know, I'm all over you. If all you've done is look around and go, ha, look at these idiots. I don't really. Is there a potential federal misdemeanor there? Maybe. Do I care? No. Well, what's the invitation? I mean, if simply by having your system poorly configured is not the same thing as having a welcome sign. It's not saying steal this car.
Have you seen the accused? It's not about the invitation, it's about the action that results from. That's what he's saying. If you have malicious intent, just because someone's walking around with a text screw up doesn't mean you can go out.
This is an excellent point. I mean, as a practical matter, what I see is that often to prove unauthorized access, all they have to do is they bring in the victim to say, like, I didn't mean he could get in there. And it's, you have to understand that, especially I think this is difficult for technical people, that permissions is not the same as permission. Just because it's set up so you can doesn't mean that you are allowed, okay? But as a practical matter, the way that law enforcement looks at it is they don't really care kind of if you get in. It is sort of what you do after, because that's what captures their imagination and makes it a great case.
When does yes mean no?
When does what?
When does yes mean no?
That's a very funny joke. I would say S means no when what you do in there is something that pisses off the prosecutor. And I had a case just like this where a web server was running this old buggy software that displayed the master password file. And it wasn't so much that the guy got the master password file that pissed off my prosecutor. What it was that he ran crack against it and then printed the de-encrypted version on IRC. That's what she got mad at. So, you know, sometimes it's the thing that happens after the fact that really gets you in the hot water.
Trafficking in passwords is a federal offense.
It's 10:29. There was a guy over there who had a question.
Hi. What kind of arrangements are made with the United States and Canada if a Canadian citizen breaks a law in the United States concerning system penetration?
Hypothetically?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I'm retired.
Hypothetically, eh?
Okay.
As you know, I cannot talk about any pending cases, and of course, my responses are my own and not the official response of the United States Department of Justice. Nevertheless, there are a number of ways that we deal with international events. Canada is actually an easy example because we have a treaty with Canada that allows for mutual legal assistance. We have an extradition treaty with Canada that is actually used fairly extensively. We share some culture with Canada so that we have an easier time talking to each other about matters of import. We have the ability and have regularly provided Canadians lawfully with information that we've obtained that they've used to prosecute their own citizens. So Canada is an easy example. There are countries, however, in which it's much more difficult, even with treaties, to gain the type of cooperation that we want where there's been international destructive behavior.
Could you address that same issue from the opposite of American citizens?
It's actually the same when we have these treaties, like with Canada. China, we do not have an extradition treaty with, so if an American citizen hacking from their own room breaks into a Chinese computer system and causes all kinds of damage, it would create some international diplomatic discussions, but the American would be in completely free from prosecution unless they happen to travel to China or a country familiar with China or a country friendly with China. Now, if China hacked back, then we get into some very interesting situations. Does China hack back as the government of China, or does it hack back as an individual who was hacked? Once, you know, we get into areas of warfare, of informational warfare, and suddenly we've gone from a very simple, hey, I got into a China system, cool. Next thing you know, we have the Chinese government responding. It's almost like a movie. And the answer to it is one that would the American ultimately get prosecuted? Probably not, because the Chinese government probably would not give us enough information to mount a successful prosecution. If they did, would we prosecute? Yes. I'm sorry. Would we send it to China for prison? No, just for re-education.
I had a question on due diligence on the places that are the jump point. You talked about civil litigation there. Mm-hmm. What sort of matrix or guide do you have to go by to show that they haven't performed due diligence?
Well, this is a tricky.
Where is that established at?
Well, you're talking about a negligence standard, and a negligence standard, you have to have a duty. There has to be a breach of that duty and damage. There's absolutely. The case law on this doesn't exist. It's basically what you have with the civil field is legislatures. It's not sexy to pass civil laws that, you know, civil penalties. You can't go out and get reelected saying I'm tough on torts. So what you have here is you have basically the common law developing through the courts, and you have the courts trying to jam technology issues that evolve daily into pigeonholed tort theories that go back to Blackstone, you know, go back 100 years. Right now we have cases about unauthorized access, basically trespass to chattel cases, the eBay case Jennifer discussed earlier, that's kind of a trespass analysis. There's a misrepresentation analysis that goes on with regard to, using passcodes. Basically, you're representing that you're the rightful owner of that passcode, and the machine is seen as the agent of the victim accepting the passcodes as being genuine. There's some real strained analysis going on here with regard to the jump point. Analysis, you're looking at a negligence. You're basically, the analysis would be, was I reasonable in the efforts that I took to protect the system from this kind of event happening? And the evidence that you would put on is, well, we came to DEF CON and hired the best security guy I could find at the bar. You know, you have to sit there, and you're going to have to show that you took reasonable steps to secure your system. And you know, if you have security consultants or in-house people who keep up to date on the latest exploits, and you can document that, you can show that they've gone to conferences, we have training programs, we've done this, we've done everything we can. You know, you've made a strong case for not being negligent. Because like I said before, you may do everything you can, but there may just be someone out there smarter than you, and you're not negligent. But you know, in the end analysis, it comes down to, convincing a jury or, you know, settling a case if you don't want bad publicity. So.
Have you ever held, like, an ISP responsible for, let's say, a client of theirs, being a jump on
the I've been on the other, I've been on the other side of that one. No, I've done, like I say, this is a developing area of the law. My background, I've done a lot of consulting and basically similar type areas going. I've gone into auto body shops and given speeches on sexual harassment and why you can't post the Hustler centerfold up on the wall. You know, it's a similar type analysis with what you have now. You know, you'd be surprised, but it's a similar type analysis to what's going on now. You basically have to take the analysis that I just described and say, well, you know, we've entered into contracts. You also have to worry about, you know, what have I represented to my clients that I can do? You may have a fraud misrepresentation claim coming your way if you've huffed and puffed and built yourself up to say you can do more than you can do. See, I'm going to need a translator for that. Okay. Well, see, that's a case where I think you have to in your contract. If you've got to make a full disclosure of exactly what you're selling them. If you're telling them that I'm giving you a system that we're monitoring and we're doing this and that, and you're not providing that, you've basically defrauded your client. If you tell them here's what you're getting, it's as is, it may be good enough, may not, you buy it at your own risk, and you can get somebody to sign off on that, good for you. You know.
That's one of the other things, aside from stealing, lying has always been wrong, will always be wrong. So if you lie to somebody to steal their money, or lie to somebody to get them to give you their money voluntarily, that's also the kind of thing that interests us, because it's simple and we're not that smart. Yes. We have to prove that the evidence that we're using is authentic. And there are ways to do that. That's why it's important. One of the things that we went back to earlier is if a company or a victim gets law enforcement involved early, then one of the things that we can do is secure a system and secure the logs, so at least at the point we have them, we know they're genuine. The issue as to whether they're genuine when we come in is a difficult one, and one we have to look at on a case-by-case basis. We have been successful 100% of the time in getting logs in. We have overcome several challenges of, because it's digital, it's ephemeral, and it could be changed and modified. And then you get to look at who these people are and what's their motivation. What is your motivation in faking these logs and bringing your system down and costing yourself $15,000? Are you that vengeful? So as a practical matter, it's not a real issue for us, although it comes up in every case.
Oh, here we go. Start over.
Thank you.
Many of the things come down to at 10:30 with authorization and the ability to grant access. If a person is on like Pound Hack and they say, I own this box, here, have an account and a password, they're committing fraud in one way, but they're also using the form of communication that is common in the culture on that channel. How will that affect a case where a person that didn't break into the box is now using that box and doing their own work and deleting files?
Again, it's the use of the box is not something that generally concerns me. I mean, there may be some unauthorized access there, but I don't care. We look at the result. If after you get access to the box, whether you've got it because you've been lied to or got it legitimately or got it illegitimately, once you start doing damage to the box and we look at why, what it is that, what kind of damage you caused, whether you did it intentionally, recklessly, or negligently, that's when we start looking at it. We look at the conduct after the fact. The mere fact of illegal access, while it is an offense, is not the kind of thing that gets us going. Okay, if a person who claims to own the box gives you access and says, go ahead and trash it, and you do, the easy answer for me is that the person who comes in, if they reasonably believe that person did own the box and gave them permission, they lacked criminal intent, and there would not be a criminal case.
Okay, officially we're out of time, but the next speaker says we can keep with questions for a few more minutes. And by the way, I just got an announcement, they have finally fixed the air conditioning.
Woohoo!
once it exceeds $5,000. It's right in the statute. And like we talked about how to get there, it has to be reasonable. But once you exceed $5,000 in costs of repair and costs of analysis, then there's federal jurisdiction if the computer was a federally protected computer. Say again. The question is, does every case in which the damage exceeds $5,000 get investigated? The question is, it depends where it occurs. In some federal districts, the resources are such that the guidelines before which the case will be investigated or prosecuted gets ratcheted up. In some districts, like mine, if you exceed $5,000, I'm looking at it. So stay out of San Diego.
The fellow in the glasses right there?
If someone breaks into your box and then proceeds to install an IRC client and use it, are there any legal problems with logging all of their actions and communications that originate from your box that they've broken into?
Jennifer talked about that yesterday. As a SIS manager, you have the right to monitor, use, and disclose to protect yourself and protect the rights that you have in the system. So you can monitor to your heart's content. That's not an issue for me. And I'm allowed, to some extent, to surf behind you. If you're a SIS manager and you're monitoring, using, and disclosing to protect yourself, I'm allowed to use that information, so long as you're acting in your best interest and not in the interest of the government. Once your interests shift, and the reason you're monitoring and disclosing is to get somebody prosecuted and not to protect yourself, the interests have changed, and I'm required to get a wiretap order, unless your system is bannered. That is, that anybody who enters your system sees something that says you have no right to privacy in this system, we're going to monitor, use, and disclose to our heart's content, beware. Then I can, as a prosecutor, I can use everything that the SIS manager does in logging.
And this goes back to the question that was asked earlier from the civil side. If you're aware of this kind of activity, what do you do? You want to document that activity for your purposes, as well as for law enforcement purposes. You want to have the ability to preserve evidence that you may use in a suit against someone else or may be used against you. You want to have that. Talk to your in-house counsel or your lawyer and notify the authorities and preserve that evidence for your own purposes.
Okay, here's another scenario. A distributed denial of service tool is used to take an e-tailer offline for an hour. That e-tailer generates $5,000 worth of income every hour they're online. Is that a prosecutable case if you can identify the source of the denial of service?
If you can identify, well, you say the source, you mean the person who triggered
Yeah, the person who triggered it.
Absolutely. Love okay. to do it.
Just curious, that's all.
Can use of bandwidth be used as a damage tool? Probably not. What we do, one of the ways that you can get federal jurisdiction is if you enter a system without authority, exceed authorized access, and steal computer time. And if that time exceeds $1,000, then we have the ability to prosecute. But mere use of bandwidth, I don't know how you can put a monetary use on it. The denial of service cases are easy because if you've shut down an e-commerce site, they can actually count or extrapolate what they've lost. If all you've done is steal some bandwidth, for the most part, Mr. Napster, then it's not the kind of thing that we'd be looking at unless there's some other intentional damage going on. How do you value time? Oh, there's a lot of companies. Some of their computer centers actually bill their departments for use of some of their mainframes, and we would just use those figures to determine the loss. Providers charge for bandwidth as well. We would use their costs.
It's my understanding that existing Supreme Court case law limits the calls unconstitutional statutes which are so vague and give prosecutors so much discretion in the prosecution that a potential offender would not necessarily know if they were subject to prosecution. How does that jibe with the amount of discretion you're saying that you have when you're choosing who to prosecute.
Well, the courts have also recognized that prosecutors can decide what to prosecute and what not. There's a difference between prosecutorial discretion and whether the law is so vague that you don't know what you're doing is illegal. The law is actually pretty clear. We can debate what is unauthorized access and when it's and what the permissions mean in that regard. But unauthorized access, if you're in a system that you know you don't have rights to, it's pretty easy. Now, I can decide as a prosecutor what the appropriate use of my resources are in order to investigate and prosecute. That's something firmly committed to the executive branch, and it doesn't raise the same issue. We can argue about whether I exercise my discretion appropriately, but as a practical matter, they're two separate ideas.
I think we're just about out of time now, since people have filtered into the room for the next talk. So any final thoughts as such? And I guess some vitamin follow you to the bar or something.
I'll buy Jennifer her first drink after this session.
That won't... thank
Jennifer
you,
is a fun drunk.
Thank you, but that won't be my first.
I said after the session.